from Hospice UK and Dying Matters, this is the Dying Matters podcast. I'm your host, Eleanor McConnell. Why should we talk about death and dying? We're all very aware that death is an inevitable part of being human, and that when it touches our lives, it's always a difficult and emotional thing to try and deal with. So why talk about it before you absolutely have to? Why be morbid? Why make your friends and family uncomfortable by talking about a subject that, let's face it, can be a real drag? The trouble is, there are so many questions around death and dying that it's important to know the answers to. What do you want to happen to your property after you die? What songs do you want played at your funeral? Do you want to be cremated or buried or something else entirely? Where do you want to die? Do you want to be an organ donor? And if you already know the answers to these questions, does anyone else know what your answers are? These kinds of practicalities aside, Dying Matters believes that a society that leans into the discomfort and talks more openly about death and dying is just ultimately a more caring and compassionate one. Death is complicated and awkward and gut-wrenching. It makes us feel so much that we need to talk about it. And that can be a really daunting prospect. But luckily, there are people out there who can help us start. This week, we're talking to two of them, professionals who have made talking about these things a part of their everyday job, but in very different ways. First up is Megan Mooney. Megan is a medical social worker and palliative care researcher based in Missouri, over in the United States. Megan's pretty comfortable talking about death and dying, like a lot of people in palliative care are. But Megan takes it a step further by helping other people to do the same. Every month, in St. Joseph, Missouri, Megan runs a death cafe. So, Megan, what is a death cafe?
So a death cafe is, it can be a pop-up event where people, often strangers, gather to eat cake, drink tea or coffee, and discuss death and all that that encompasses. So our objective of Death Cafe is to increase awareness of death with the view of helping people make the most of their finite lives. A Death Cafe is a group-directed discussion of death, so we don't have any agendas. There's no objectives or themes. It's a discussion group that's led by the attendees. It's not a grief support or counseling session. There's always a facilitator at a death cafe, and most of the facilitators have some kind of professional background in death and dying, whether that be a therapist, bereavement counselor, social worker, psychologist. Our death cafes are always offered on a non-profit basis, so they're free. They're in an accessible, respectful, and confidential space. What's said at a death cafe, stays there. There's no intention of leading people to any conclusion, product, or course of action. We don't, try to sell them anything or lead them to believe anything. We always provide refreshment. So drinks, nourishing food, and cake.
And cake's important, right?
Yes, it's very important. We believe that people feel more comfortable talking about death if they have something life-sustaining like cake to eat. John, who's our founder of Death Cafe, he always said cake and tea were a must. Some people have a fear that talking about death, that you attract it, that you attract death and it's make it more likely to happen to you. So eating and drinking are more conscious acts of nurturing the body. So we believe that it helps mitigate that fear. So the Death Cafe model was developed by John Underwood and his mom, Sue Barsky Reed, based on the ideas of Bernard Curtaz. The first Death Cafe was held in the UK, and it was held in John's house, actually in his basement in Hackney, and that was in September 2011. It was facilitated by his mom, who's a psychotherapist, and that's Subarsky Reed. After that, they went on to offer death cafes in a range of places, including cafes, people's houses, cemeteries, and the Royal Festival Hall. Then John and Sue produced a guide to running your own death cafe. And then John started deathcafe.com, where others could connect around death and dying, learn about death cafe and how to start their own, and connect with others. This was published in February 2012. The first person to pick it up outside of the UK was Lizzie Miles from Columbus, Ohio. Following that, hundreds of people have worked to provide death cafes across the globe. And now we have had over 5,000. I think we're almost at 6,000. And we just had our 56th country host a death cafe.
So it's a real global movement.
Yes, absolutely. It's just, you know, and I know John never thought it would, you know, take off like this. And it did, you know, it's been a huge success. And, you know, it shows that people really want to have those conversations. I started Death Cafe St. Joe in March of 2013. So it's been almost 5 years. And then in June 2013, I started running the Facebook page, the international main Facebook page for Death Cafe. And it's been very, very interesting to see, you know, people from all sorts of different backgrounds and countries, and they come together because they want to have this authentic conversation around death. It's been remarkable.
And the model has stayed the same from when John started it at his house?
Absolutely, yeah. We have not changed at all. You know, it has always been a group-directed conversation. So we do not have, we don't have agendas. So there's no, you know, the one thing that we usually will start with is, what brought you here tonight to talk about death? And then that takes on a life of its own. Then people start having all sorts of conversations on why they wanted to come talk about death. And, you know, the interesting thing that I've noticed is that this is strangers that are coming together to talk about death, and they feel more comfortable talking to strangers about death than they are their own family members. And I've had a lot of people come up to me after a death cafe and thank me for hosting it, because they said, you know, I've tried to talk to my family and friends about this, and they tell me I'm morbid and they don't want to talk about it. You know, so it's, there's such a need for it. But yeah, you know, still to this day, people don't understand what a death cafe is. And I'll have people that ask me, do you still have your cafe? And they think I own a, you know, business. And the first news article that ever came out about my death cafe was in the St. Joe News Press, and they got several things wrong. But this older lady was getting her hair done where my husband was getting his done at. And she said to the hairstylist, did you read about that death cafe that's coming to town? That's just horrible. Because so many people have this misconception that, like, it was a place you went to die, you know? And I know in Singapore, I helped them, Death Cafe Singapore, and they had the same thing. So many people thought you were going there to drink tea that would kill you. So yeah, there's been a lot of things that we've had to deal with, but, you know, people came and loved it, and people were so afraid to come. And then they came, and then they've been regular attendees, and we have a lot of regular attendees that come every month. And that's what's been so beautiful. I have a really cool story about my dad. My dad actually just died 2 months ago.
I'm so sorry.
Thanks. It's been really hard. But Death Cafe actually really changed my dad's life. And he was actually interviewed about it like a year and a half ago. And he talked about how much Death Cafe had an impact on his life and how now, you know, he had felt ready if he were to die. And he knew that he was going to die soon. But the first time he came to my very first Death Cafe and he told me he was coming. Well, I had tried to talk to my dad about, you know, what do you want at the, you know, what decisions do you want at the end of your life? You know, we need to get that your affairs in order. What do you want for your funeral? And he would never talk about it. And so he came to my first one and I said, well, Dad, do you know what a Death Cafe is? And he said, well, it's like AA meeting, right? And I said, no, Dad, it's nothing like AA. So he came and I was very worried about that. And then also my aunt came and my uncle had just died a couple months before. And he died a horrible death. And that was my dad's brother. So I was very worried about that because she'd went to some bereavement groups and wasn't able to talk about it. She would, you know, just was very sad. And so I was afraid that, you know, she thought it was something it wasn't, but it was so beautiful. It was the first time she was able to talk about my uncle's death without getting upset, and talk about it and process it with others, you know. And then I look over at my dad and he's laughing and having a good time with these people. And the next week I told him that they were trying to get one of my cousins was trying to get my aunt to move to Springfield. And my dad said, well, don't you know that you shouldn't be making any big decisions after a major loss and da da da. And I said, well, yeah, Dad, I know that, but how do you know that? And he said, from the ladies at my table at the Death Cafe. I was like, wow, you know. And then he came to every single Death Cafe I had except for one because he was out of town. And through that, you know, he really realized the importance of things and had these intense conversations with people. And he planned his funeral, planned his songs. He did all of his end of life wishes. And it was really cool to see, you know, he, up until the very end, you know, he fought for his quality of life. And that's something that I know he wouldn't have done had he not went to those and had conversations with others.
And do you think it helped your dad have these conversations with you and the rest of your family, as well as in the space of the Death Cafe?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, it was actually a week and a half before he got really sick. It ended up in the hospital and then we got him home from the hospital and on hospice and he had a really peaceful death. He was on palliative care, outpatient palliative care, and he was talking to his nurse and social worker and we were reading the article that he was in. And he was telling them how important it is to talk about death. And, you know, the article was talking about, he said that he, you know, knew he was spiritually ready and had planned all these things out and was ready that way. And he knew he wouldn't have been had he not started going to Death Cafe. He talked about it to me all the time. I don't think he talked about it with my other siblings that much. And you know, he did a couple times, but I know when we got home from the hospital, he was having a good day and we called everybody using FaceTime and he was, cause it was unexpected what happened at that time. He called everybody and explained what happened, what was going on. You know, his prognosis was a week and, you know, it was really cool to see him be able to do that and have that honest conversation and talk to them. And there was a couple of things he wanted to finish, and he got to do that. I really don't think he would have been at peace had he not have had those conversations. And, you know, you can't talk about death without talking about life. So, and you would, a lot of people think that Death Cafe would be depressing, and it's not. You know, people laugh all the time. It's a fun time. It's a good time. I mean, there are somber moments, but there's more laughter than there are tears. And a lot of people talk about how they want to live, you know, and how do our views of death inform the way we live. We have a certain time left, and the question is, what is important for me to do in that time? So, you know, they do that, and you can really see how after a while that sinks in, and then your subconscious takes over, and you start living that way. Your choices are based on that. Your relationships, you know, it's very cool to watch it.
And how do you feel after a session?
I feel very energized by it. It energizes me. I love it. It's a huge passion of mine. You know, since I was a little girl, I've had a close relationship with death. I don't really know why. My mom was a guardian of my grandma. And so whenever my grandma had a friend die, we went to the visitation. And I just remember I would always go up and look at the body. And it just was always curious to me and fascinating to me. And I live right by a cemetery. And so I grew up hanging out at the cemetery, and it was my peaceful place. And so once I got older, you know, I went to the cemetery like every day, and it's still my peaceful place. I actually started school to be a mortician, and then I changed my mind and I became a social worker. I got my master's in social work and wanted to do grief and loss counseling. And so I started working in hospice. I've been a hospice social worker and bereavement counselor, and then I've been doing research and end of life for about 5 years, and it's just something I love. I feel like opening up the conversations about death reduces this taboo surrounding death conversations, and I believe that if people are more educated about end of life decisions and about what they want and how they want to live their lives, then we can promote a better quality of life for people and for their caregivers. And as a social worker, I feel that it's important to bring social change to our society, and Death Cafe guidelines support these principles. So it's something that is perfect for me. You know, the summer was so hard on me, you know. John died unexpectedly in June, who's our founder. And a week to the day of that is when I found out my dad had cancer. So, and then my dog of 17 years had died. So it was like everything hit me. Yeah, it was very strange. And John, you know, now Sue, his mom, and his sister Jules are running Death Cafe. But it's been really hard to process all these deaths. You know, even though I work in death and dying, you know, it's like it all hits you. The thing I can say about John is, you know, there's so many things I could say about him, but he was the most amazing person I've ever met and the most true and authentic person. He lived exactly as he spoke and represented himself, you know, And he would always say, you know, to give people hugs like it was the last one, because you never knew how it was going to be. And that's what he did, you know. And so he was the most caring person ever. And so I think it's so cool that we're all continuing on his legacy. So, yeah, I want to continue to bring his vision to life and keep doing this.
That was Megan Mooney of Death Cafe. You can find out more about Death Cafes and search for ones in your area by going to www.deathcafe.org. Coming up next, I talk with Barbara Altunian, an interviewer who, when it comes to the difficult questions, won't take no for an answer. Stay with us. Every year in May, Dying Matters and other members of the Dying Matters Coalition host an Awareness Week, which gives us an unparalleled opportunity to place the importance of talking about dying, death and bereavement firmly on the national agenda. In 2018, the week will run from the 14th to the 20th of May, and we will be asking, what can you do in your community? There will be events happening up and down the country, including death cafes, for the whole of that week and beyond. You can find out more and see events happening in your area by going to www.dyingmatters.org/awareness week. Next, I talk to Barbara Altunian, aka the hospice biographer. Barbara is a very experienced TV and radio interviewer who has spent over 30 years working for the likes of BBC and Channel 4. She is used to talking to all kinds of people, but her first ever interview was more challenging than most.
I got the idea for the hospice biographers, in a sense, when I was in my 20s. And my dad was declared terminally ill. He is a character from a book called The Swallows and Amazons. And he also created, by using himself as a guinea pig, he was a self-experimenter. He also created a famous anti-asthma drug called Intal. And so he was dying prematurely. I myself was just about to become a BBC journalist. And I delayed becoming a BBC journalist and said to my family, "Ooh, brothers and sisters, mum, can I record Dad on audio? I'd like to do his life story now that we know that he's dying." And they were all absolutely appalled at the idea. They were really appalled and said, "No, no, Barbara, stop being nosy, stop being horrible, leave the man alone." So I said, "Can we resolve it by asking him?" Asked him, and he said, "Oh, Bob, that's a great idea. Come on then, let's do it." So I postponed my BBC training course and I recorded his life story without much idea of how to do interviews. I was very young. And we recorded them. We had a great time. I had to learn how to use the equipment, so lots of things went wrong. And I realised that he'd had a life before I was born, which was something that I hadn't appreciated. I was such a self-absorbed 24-year-old. And we recorded his life story. And 2 weeks after I finished, he died. And all of my brothers and sisters said, "Bob, can I have a copy?" Yeah. And so it was in the back of my mind. I then progressed to have a career in television. And then when I sold my TV business, I thought, well, what am I going to do? And I've always loved and done lots of audio recordings for people. So I thought I'd be an audio biographer and started doing that. And then for free, I offered it to my local hospice. That was 2.5 years ago. One of my patients, who was very patient in her personality, said to me, "Barbara, do you realise this is not the only hospice in Britain? You could try this audio biography everywhere." And that was, in a sense, when it all started. And that was a little bit more than a year ago. Mm-hmm. And we haven't looked back since.
Yeah. And so going back to the first time you did it, did you feel intimidated at all in talking to your father about these kinds of things?
I wasn't intimidated at all, but that's only because I was too stupid to know what the hazards and dangers were. I think it's much better if you can get somebody who doesn't know the person to interview them. just because they can't sidestep, you know, difficult questions. I just went marching in there without a care in the world and all the optimism of youth, and just had a go. And fortunately, my dad, who, you know, he was an understanding, empathetic sort, and he was a character in Swallows and Amazons, and he did this thing for medicine. He was kind of used to being interviewed and all the rest of it, so he was very kind. But others are not, and so it can go wrong. I made loads of mistakes. You know, I was kind of just all over the place, and the machinery kept on breaking down, and, oh, dear, I made such a terrible mess. But in the end, I did learn. And one of the most important things I learned, I think, is to actually listen. To actually listen and to have very open-ended questions, very simple questions, which allow the interviewer latitude but direction about what they want to say.
Mm-hmm. And why do you think your family reacted the way that they did when you first suggested it?
I think it's very English, if you don't mind. my father is Anglo-Syrian and my mum's German, so it's not true to say that we're English at all, but I think their instincts are quite English, in the sense that they're quite reserved and quite careful, and my brothers and sisters, of which I have many, were just protective of Dad. They weren't being mean or horrible. They were just literally thinking, she's a nosy old cow, you know. They were just trying to protect Dad. But when I asked Dad, I said, look, you know, you're very welcome to say no. You could see the glint in his eye. He was going, oh, great fun. Let's do it, Bob. You know, we'll do it. And because he was so obviously looking forward to it, once I suggested the idea, I couldn't really go back. So I just kind of carried on. Warts and all, we just mustered through. And I have to say, he enjoyed it so much because you can hear him. One of the joys of audio interviews is that you can hear the ambience of the room. So I've got bangles and you can hear them. And my kids always say, oh, we can hear you down the street, Mum, because we can hear your... And with my dad, he used to smoke a pipe and you could hear him scratching the sides of the pipe with his penknife. He also drank very disgusting homemade wine, which is more like vinegar. And you could hear him, you know, putting it into a glass. And then you can hear my little sister Heidi coming into the dining room where I recorded, hello, Barbara, what are you doing? And you can hear my mother come marching in. Heidi, was machst du, come here, you know, because she's German. And pull it. So you can hear, and the front doorbell and the phone. They're kind of once-in-a-lifetime audio treasures of your childhood, which are the sounds, warts and all, of one's home. So I only have to listen to any of that, and I just spring into tears everywhere. Wow. It's very embarrassing. But, you know, I love my audio recording of my dad. It's one of the most precious things I've got. I put it onto iCloud. But, you know, there was a house fire. I would definitely try and preserve my originals, just because they just tell a story.
Mm. And do you listen back to it very often?
No, I don't listen back, but I'm very proud that I've got them. But it's just so emotional. Even now, it's, you know, many years ago since he died. And I don't know, I just... When Dad starts talking about his life, and it just brings back all those memories, and I just loved him so much. And I only regret that I didn't do my mother as well. Mm. I spent so much time and trouble on him that when it came to my mum, I just sort of took her for granted, which I think is, you know, quite horrible, really. And I feel guilty about that. And I always think that if I had a penny for the pound of any of all those people who say to me, oh, Barbara, what a great idea. If only I'd recorded my dad, my mum, my sister, my aunt, my wife. You know, I would be definitely a millionaire by now. And I kind of feel that I did well recording my father, but did badly in not recording my mum.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think hearing the voices of people who died, why do you think that evokes such a strong reaction in us? Because I've had that same reaction too, I'll tell you a little anecdote. My grandmother's funeral, my mum dug up some recordings that a family member had made a long time ago. She was just narrating some stuff about her childhood. And I didn't know that they were going to be played until the night before the funeral. And I said, oh, I need to listen to them now, because if I hear them at the funeral, that will be it. And on it, so my grandma, she had a way of talking where she laughed at the end of every sentence. She used it like a full stop, just like this little giggle. But because she had a stroke 4 years before she died, I had not heard that laugh in 4 years. And then suddenly there it was on the recording. And it was the most affecting thing. And it's hard to pinpoint exactly what it is about the voice.
I think it's because if you're listening to a voice, you see more pictures compared to television. I know that sounds nonsense, but it is, because it provokes your imagination. You've got to do the hard work. You've got to engage. And so there are numerous pictures that conjure up in your brain as you hear the voice coming through. Whereas if everything's slammed into your face, noise, pictures, everything, it's almost too much. You know, I spent 30-odd years in television, but I think audio, sound, is far more provocative. And it gives you the whole ambience of the room, as I've said, and it does make you look at pictures far more. Also, from a practical point of view, if you're terminally ill, do you really want to be remembered how you were when you were ill? Or do you want to be remembered for your voice? Mm. My patients, you know, want to be remembered for who they are, not their illness. And they're always very lively with just a microphone in between us. Whereas if there's a bloody great big television there, or even if it's a small smartphone, I just think it's too intrusive. What we do is we train journalists and nurses and people who are good listeners to become hospice biographers in a 2-day training course that we created basically out of all the mistakes that I made when I was a hospice biographer at Princess Alice. So we teach people what the procedures are if the boundaries are broken. And if things go wrong in the interview, what do you do? Do you try and fix them yourself? Probably not. Go and see your head of daycare. Go and see a social worker. We've organised in all the hospices for people who record life stories to be given supervisors so that there's a chain of command if they should ever interview, I don't know, a murderer or a paedophile, God forbid, or somebody who's completely outside the realms of our remit. And that's what we do.
Yeah. So what happens when you step into the hospice for the first time? Like, how do you go about explaining to patients what it is that you're doing? And
well, in my case, I've never really been inside a hospice before, other than run a little jumble sale at a hospice in Hackney where I work, called St. Joseph's. But that's the only hospice experience that I'd had. So when I went into daycare at Princess Alice to be an audiobiographer, a volunteer audiobiographer, I would go up to people and say, oh, hello, patient. I'm Barbara. I'm here to record your life story on audio. Do you want it? And they'd say, no, go away. Who are you? We haven't seen you before. In the nicest possible way, they would say, bugger off. And so I went, oh, okay, and went to another patient, and then it just seemed to be the case that nobody wanted their life story done. So I thought, oh, okay, well, I'll go and make the tea, and maybe I should just work in that little art corner over there where they're making Christmas cards. So I did that, and then I came back the following session when I was supposed to be audio recording, and exactly the same thing happened. Nobody, in fact, one of the patients said, look, whatever it is you want, the answer is no, I don't want it. I thought, that's pretty conclusive.
But you kept coming back.
The third time I came back, somebody said, you know, your tea is awful. You're not very good at art. What I'm going to do is I'm going to submit myself to you just to shut you up, really. And let's see how it goes. And that patient turned out to be my saviour, because after that, you know, everybody wanted it. Everybody could understand it. It's just because it was new. And not many people, or nobody, I don't know how many people have done it before me, but I don't think there's anybody else that's done it before us. So, you know, we were just completely unknown to them. And if you're battling against illness, the last thing you want is some strange thing or person wandering up to you, asking you about something that they know nothing about. They just think, oh, I can't be bothered with this. No, go away.
And it's a lot of trust and intimacy you're asking from them.
Oh, it's huge. And also, they give you their soul in a way, because there's no time limit on our interviews. And some talk for half an hour, some talk for three hours. And when I've interviewed them, you feel as though you've been inside their soul, their whole being. I'm just stretching out to the interviewer's chest at the moment. But do you know what I mean? You're all right in there. And then when they see you, could be months later at the same daycare, they say, Barbara, must tell you, you know Edward? Well, you know, he's got into the university, you know. And it's kind of like they think, and actually I do remember, you know, but they've admitted you into everything. So they jolly well believe that they own you. And in a way, you own them as well, in a funny kind of way.
Yeah.
It's a therapy without wishing to be a therapy, but it is a therapy. And it's an immensely privileged position to be in. And I feel just incredibly glad and lucky and fortunate that I'm doing it.
And why do you think it works better for someone else to do it, as opposed to a family member or a friend?
I think if you're a family member, there are too many complications. You know, there are too many kind of, you know, people, oh, don't you be bothering about that, my dear daughter. You know, you don't have to know about that. Or whereas if you're objective and you're a stranger, you're in a delightful position to hear a declaration and then for you to say, well, why'd you do that? And how long did that take? And goodness gracious, what happened then? And of course, you know, you are completely new to it. You are unjudgmental. You are a person at a bus stop, really. You could be anybody.
Yeah.
And it's just one of those things that you just have a delightful time with them. And they always start in trepidation, really, and then by the end they say, oh, they slam the table like that, Barbara, I really enjoyed that, thank you ever so much. You, on the other hand, completely exhausted. But they always, I've never had one patient, I've been doing it a long time now, who said, oh, I feel dreadful, that was awful. They all just love it. They're quiet, they're exuberant, they're shy, they're distracted, but they all kind of come out of it feeling much enthused by the whole occasion.
Mm.
And they put their judgment and they slam the table like that, and they say, you know, gosh, that was marvellous, I put the world to rights. Or they've been cathartic.
Yeah.
Or they've told their grandchildren. Oh yeah, the best bit of what we do is we say to them at the end, now, are there any messages to any of your family or friends? And these days, because I've been doing it for so long there now, they've got these bits of paper. Shuffle, 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 shuffle. And they bring it out and they say, right, this message is for my grandson, Edward. And I want him to know that he's got to stop picking his nose, because I will still be watching. And I'm going to say to my dear daughter, Brenda, that she should stop being nice to her husband. So far, she gives him much too much stick. And it's really like, you know, it's, but it just makes you cry, really, because it's so personal. And so, and all of it is all so well meant. And while I'm doing somebody's hospice biography, I often get interrupted. People come barging into the room. I've got a little room, much as I'm recording in now. But we've got a beautiful view of a field in Esher. And people, there's a big sign outside saying, do not disturb. But they come barging in and they say, are you that Barbara? And I think, oh God, do I owe any money? What's going to happen to me? And I say, yes, could be. And they say, we just want to know where that Barbara is, because we want to tell you that we love it. My dad has never given us that detail, has never told us about X, Y, and Z, and you've been so clever in extracting it all from him. And I say, oh, yes, been terribly clever, yes. And they say, well, you are so clever. Why has he told you all this detail and not me? And I say, well, because he obviously loves me more than you. And she goes, no. I say, of course not. It's because I'm a complete stranger. And they can tip it all out.
Yeah.
And they don't have to hold back and worry about what your mum's going to think and your cousins are going to think. It's all a complete stranger who's a good listener. And they laugh when I say all that. And they're very grateful.
Yeah. So you talk to people about their life stories. Do you ever talk to them about their death? Talking to terminally ill patients?
You should know that all our life stories are chronological. That means that we record people's life stories from the very beginning, from their time of birth, up to current day.
And why is that important?
Very important because in the human mind, there's something which says, I like symmetry, I like developmental memory recall. They like the fact that it starts at the beginning, goes into the middle, and finishes in current day. Because of its logic, there's something about the human brain that can tip the very early memories, the middle memories, and almost to the end in a fantastic, clear detail. I mean, I've had some patients who've said to me, I remember my grandfather when I was about 5. He had these great big hairs coming out of his nose. And he had, you know, sparkling blue eyes, which always matched his pyjamas or things like that. In other words, the recall, if you do the interviews in the right way, is massive, absolutely huge. And we're actually looking for academic evaluation to find out why it's the case from a neurological point of view. But it is definitely the case that if you do your recording chronologically, you will get far more detail about their lives, what they developed into, the kinds of peer groups they had at the time, the family that created them and made them the people they were today, and then their current situation. Some of our patients are younger than me. They're not old, all of them. And we're getting an increasing number of patients aged between 29 and 39 in outpatients and hospices who are terminally ill and whose children, babies, will never know them. Mm. So we are being asked to record them on film because their babies will want to know what they look like.
Yeah.
We're also being increasingly asked to do outreach hospice work, which is with prisoners, the homeless, and travellers. So so long as it's hospice-related, that's where our interviews go.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we can't extend beyond that because it's just too much.
Yeah. And do you ever get to talking about the end?
We do. We do. What they mainly say is that they feel that they're in a situation where they want things to be tidy. They want things to be sorted. Who gets what in their will? What happens to all that furniture in their house? What happens to the possessions in the attic that they can no longer approach? Or worse still, down stairs into their basement? They want everything to be tidy. And unlike being run over by a bus when you least expect it, when you're in palliative care, the great thing is that you can plan the type of death that you're having, and you can plan what happens to your family and to your friends. And you've got time to write lists and think about your future.
I think something I hear a lot working for Hospice UK and working on Dying Matters is kind of the reaction that you are quite a strange person to want to talk about these things so much. But from what you're saying, it sounds like it's almost, once you know how to listen, it's kind of the most natural thing in the world, right? And I think it's so much talking, so much of talking about death is also talking about life. It's the two are the same, right?
Exactly. You're not a weirdo at all, and you shouldn't think that you are. You should be very proud of working for Dying Matters / Hospice UK. It is just natural. It is paying taxes, being born, dying. It's just rites of passage, I'm afraid, all humans will go through. It's natural. And if you're curious and inquiring, you're probably very intelligent as well. It's only those people who are uncreative, unquestioning, unthinking that die eventually in blissful ignorance of anything, really. Because you've got to analyse life, which means you've got to talk. You've got to be in discussion with somebody. You can't just look at a wall, blank wall, and talk to yourself.
Yeah.
You need to be in discussion. And so being in conversation with other people about life, death, marriage, birth, God knows what, is just been going on since, you know, pre-classical times. The first grunt from, you know, Neanderthal man started with, you know, pass me that club or whatever, you know.
And it's strange, given that we've been living with it for so long, that culturally we're still not at a stage where we're all comfortable with it.
Well, some cultures are not just not comfortable with it, they see it as a taboo subject.
Yeah.
If you're from where I am, so my antecedent, where I was born, is a place called Aleppo in Syria, which you might have heard about in all the troubles that we've been having there. In the Middle East, you are not invited to talk about death. You're not invited to talk about suffering from terminal illness. It's very much the case that it's taboo. It's only in the Western world, which, thanks to Dying Matters, actually, in the last 2 or 3 years, maybe, they've broken through the boundaries and barriers.
You think you've seen that change, then?
Oh, I've definitely seen that change. Yeah. In the last 2 or 3 years, it's mainly things like dying, the death cafe, and just calling Dying Matters. It's like, whoa, what's that about? You know, it's definitely the case that as recent as 3 or 4 years ago, people would not discuss it.
And now, thanks to people like Barbara, we talk about it more. Right now, Barbara is looking for volunteers to help the charity grow, and also for palliative care researchers to help her evaluate the work the charity is doing and evidence why it's such a beneficial thing for her interviewees and people at the end of life. If that sounds like you, get in touch via the website www.thehospicebiographers.org. Many thanks to our guests this week, Megan Mooney and Barbara Altunian, and special thanks also to the amazing Bernadette Ryan for our theme music. Dying Matters is a part of Hospice UK, the national charity for hospice care. If you enjoyed our podcast, make sure you rate and review us on the iTunes store so that we can reach even more people and get everyone talking. Is there anything you want to talk about? You can get in touch with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Dying Matters. Next time, we're talking about your before I die wishes. What do you want to do before you die?